Hello, everybody. So, enough is more than enough. I wondered if it might sound a bit worthy, that title, but I'm hoping that I will amplify that and explain that actually it's fun, it's exciting, it's abundant. I'm going to be talking about the topic of sufficiency, attitudes around plenty and lack, and the creative spiral of abundance. What is enough? And when is enough genuinely more than enough, if indeed it is? So I've been really inspired by this whole topic. As one or two of my friends know, as I've been talking about it rather a lot, by reading a book by Lynn Twist called The Soul of Money. And it didn't particularly grab me as a title, but another friend recommended it very, very highly, and I ended up reading it, and it's been quite transformative in the last few months. And the author has worked as a fundraiser and campaigner for the Hunger Project, which is a huge project around feeding the world. And during her decades of work in the Hunger Project, she has worked with huge corporations in encouraging investments, and also worked with some of the poorest people on the planet and some people in tribal communities who are outside the money economy. So she's really spanned the different aspects of life, economically, you might say. And one of her most fascinating, at least to me, conclusions is that scarcity is a lie. Scarcity is a lie. It's not that resources are infinite. Of course, they're not infinite. But there is enough of anything or of everything if only we knew it and knew how to channel our resources differently or better. And this is for a woman, for example, who's worked with people in the desert who objectively seem to have not quite enough water, for example. So this idea that scarcity is not a fact is really fascinating to me, because there is in our culture today very much a built-in assumption that, well, that there's not enough and that we each need to scrabble for the existing resources. And this belief is in ourselves, it's kind of in contemporary dialogue, and it's in a lot of our society's structures as well, I think. And it seems to, I reckon, fuel our competitive urges, the dog-eat-dog kind of attitude. Internally, many of us are driven by a sense of not-enoughness. I certainly know I am, and people I've been talking about with this recognise this. So we're not clever enough or fit enough or wise enough or good enough, I could keep going, informed enough, kind enough, creative enough, rich enough, thin enough, all that kind of thing. You probably don't recognise all of them in your experience, but I bet some of them resonate. And we also tell ourselves we don't have enough time, don't have enough friends or energy or qualifications or power or something of that ilk. And most of us labour under this tyranny of lack every day. Sometimes before we've even got out of bed, we've had a few of those thoughts. Haven't had enough sleep. Certainly have that one quite often. I don't know if you recognise this. But how does it make you feel? Certainly makes me feel exhausted. So I was thinking, how can we challenge this sense of inner lack and cultivate an innate sense of enoughness, of sufficiency? Because sufficiency is an attitude. It's a context that we can kind of bring forth in ourselves. It's not about the amount that we have of anything. It's not an outer thing at all. And it doesn't actually mean, sufficiency doesn't mean we don't aspire to things or strive for something more. But it's about finding more within ourselves. With the sufficiency outlook, if we look around us and within us, we will find what we need. At least this is the premise I'm going to put forth today. see if you agree by the end. So certainly this woman, Lynn Twist, says that we engage in life from a sense of our own wholeness. And if we do that, then that desperate longing to be enough that we often act out by going to buy a new jacket or booking on the next training course, actually we can have that sense of completeness through our own outlook and attitude. If we're willing to abandon that chase to acquire more, to accumulate, whatever it is. But if we do that, then we can take all the energy that we expend in that way and invest it in making more of what we do have. And when you do that, unimagined treasures arise. That's the theory. And I'll tell you a few stories where I really am starting to believe that's true. It's certainly very powerful. As Lynn Twist says, when you let go of trying to get more of what you don't really need, it frees up oceans of energy to make a difference with what you already have. And when you make a difference with what you have, it expands. So she identifies three key beliefs that keep us from abundance and keep us stuck in this scarcity mindset. So the first one is that there's not enough, which I've already mentioned a bit. So the belief that resources are scarce, resources of whatever kind are scarce, so there's not enough. The second view or belief that keeps us stuck is that more is better. More is better, of whatever sort. Having more, we equate with being cleverer, more capable, more important, whatever. So there's not enough, more is better, and that's just the way things are. Just the way things are. So we feel helpless. We feel we can't make a difference. The problem is unsolvable. So these are the three beliefs that she's identified that I certainly recognise in myself and those I meet. That definitely keep us stuck. And she reckons that time and time again, the key lies in empowering people to author their own change. And in a sense, look at these three beliefs. So I'll talk about that a bit more in a minute. So I've been personally exploring this theme of abundance for quite a few months now. And in recent months, whenever I've caught myself in this lack mode, I don't have enough time, haven't had enough sleep, I'm not good enough, or whatever it is, I've been making a conscious choice to stand in a different attitude. And it can be a choice. It sounds quite simple, but if I do notice it, which is obviously, you know, a big part of it, it involves noticing and then choosing self-care and self-acceptance. Focusing on the skills and resources that I do have, rather than where I might lack, and making more of those, because what we appreciate appreciates. It expands. So this move to sufficiency isn't about the amount of anything, as I've said. It's about our relationship to what we have or don't have. And it's not simply that cliche that we all know about the glass half full or half empty. I mean, there's a bit of that, but it goes further, much, much further than that. So according to Twist, even when there are genuinely scarce resources, like water for desert people or food for beggars in Mumbai or wherever it is, it's the desire and capacity for self-sufficiency that are innate in us that are enough to meet the challenge. It's around that if we don't have a crushed spirit. So it's really about the view, the attitude. It's the crushed spirit that seems to be the pivotal factor. And, well, which goes along with these three beliefs about there's not enough, more is better, and it's just the way it is. So for us, how can we choose to make a difference with what we have? You know, whatever income we may or may not be on. Because the experience of sufficiency and fulfillment arises when we choose to make a difference with the resources that are available. In other words, when we use whatever we have to support our ideals and values. And then the experience of our own wealth expands. So there's a very moving story about, it's from a hilly region in Bangladesh. In a piece of land, a tract of land that seemed very dry and infertile, wasn't one in the flood regions, and the only plant that was growing there was this poison berry thorny bush. And it was very invasive, and it had taken over vast tracts of land. And the people there were largely despondent and dependent on foreign aid. And many families were getting to the desperation point of going to send their men away to get work in the capital or where else, and just to survive. And the Hunger Project, through past experience and through dialoguing with Bangladeshi leaders, realised the key to supporting self-sufficiency was for locals to have a vision of their own capabilities, of what was possible. So they set up workshops called Vision, Commitment and Action. And in them, people were invited to imagine Bangladesh as a country able to export its finest goods, proud of its own culture and arts and poetry and sport and so on, and as a country contributing to the global community in some ways and not dependent on aid. And in these workshops that they set up, people were invited to imagine this dream of self-reliance and hope, in a sense. And they said time and again, tears began to flow down people's faces when they were invited to imagine this vision. And one young man who lived in the hill region went down to the capital and attended, almost by chance, one of these workshops. And he was inspired to go back home and redouble his efforts and collaborate. So he shared this vision he'd had in the workshop with six of his mates back in the hill region. And they determined together to borrow and fundraise for tools to clear this prickly bush from the land. And they managed to persuade the local government to give them, I think, only about 17 acres at first to clear. And in a few months, the young men had come up with a plan for an agribusiness designed to bring the hill region out of poverty. And these seven men then led their own Vision, Commitment and Action workshop for 600 people locally. And that inspired them to sign up to commit to clearing the land. And they trained youths who turned to crime and begging to cultivate instead. And they trained a number of destitute women who normally wouldn't be allowed to work to farm. And they all set to, and they discovered that beneath this jungle of prickly bush, there was actually a river and there was a lake and it was full of fish. And seeing that this was working, the government officials released more land that they'd already deemed was unusable. So they weren't really giving up much anyway. And before long, the region became self-sufficient and the crime rate dropped by a remarkable 70%. And they accomplished this with almost no outside help. And the key lay in abundant thinking. This shift from hopelessness to vision and action. And according to a Hunger Project spokesperson, they had what they needed all along. They had the land, they had water, or so they discovered, they had the intelligence, the muscle, the capability, but they just lost touch with those resources in this climate of foreign aid and the sense of helplessness that had come with it, and presumed incompetence, I think. But once they were inspired to see themselves as capable, according to this spokesman, success was inevitable. I find it very moving. These young men became known as the Magnificent Seven. So how do we move away from an attitude of lack or hopelessness and embrace abundance? So So I was thinking that firstly, abundance isn't about excess, even though the two can sometimes be thought of in the same light, in a sense. It's not about excess, and excess tends to bring suffering. Not always. But we can either feel bad or guilty for having too much and worry about things like waste and fairness, or we get into a hoarding mentality with a sense of craving or fear of future security. And both those responses to excess are unskillful, and they're also unenjoyable, actually. My granny used to say that enough is as good as a feast, which you probably know that old-fashioned expression. But I think it goes, in a way it's wise folklore, but I think it goes further than that. Well, I'd like to take it a bit further. I know through my work with nonviolent communication that when we imagine that all people's needs can't be met, we automatically start to move to a scarcity mindset. And if I think that both our needs can't be met or valued, I either kind of get into a grab for myself or do the opposite and I don't ask for them for myself and I sort of give up. And neither way is very creative, I think. In neither way, all needs are being valued and met. So this attitude of lack limits our relationships a lot, and it kind of limits our thinking, and then it limits what's possible. It's what I call the either-or paradigm. It's either you or me. And if it's you, I worry that it'll be at my expense. So there's another type of lack attitude. In fact, there's probably many. But another type of lack attitude is more despondent, like it'll never happen. Or I can't, or you can't, or there's not enough, as I was saying earlier. So it starts with our thinking, doesn't it? Which reminds me of a line from a William Stafford poem that probably many of you may know. Are you waiting for life to show you some better thoughts? So it's crucial to notice our scarcity thoughts so we can drop them, in a sense, and embrace a sense of interconnectedness in which everybody matters and something bigger could be possible. The practical aspect of abundant thinking is practicing not comparing ourselves. It's so common for many of us to do that we might need to be quite disciplined. So with comparing, you're definitely in that mindset. Either I'm not enough or they're not enough. And so we're stuck in that duality again. And cut off from the other person in that instance. So I had quite a strong experience of this last month prior to a course abroad. So I was worried about attending because I hadn't done my homework, I hadn't practiced, I felt rusty. I didn't know that many people and I was feeling unconfident about going. And when my key friend and travel companion over there had to cancel, I almost did too. And then I consciously decided that I was going to practice abundant thinking. So I am enough just as I am. So I was telling myself, and it felt, in that moment, it felt a really radical thought. Am I really? Could I possibly be? And, I hadn't practiced, that's true. And I might be the least skilled in the group, and I might not sleep. And I hadn't been on the diet that I'd planned to go on beforehand, and all various other thoughts. But never mind, I am enough. And whenever my intention slipped, I had to keep coming back to that. And amazingly, really amazingly to me anyway, my worries evaporated on the journey before I'd even arrived. And I just had a really fantastic week. I really enjoyed myself. And I felt very relaxed. And part of why I felt enough was that I stayed in that place of being enough. So it is, the outer things hadn't changed, but the attitude had changed. I felt enough. And other people related to that. At least I think they did. A couple of them are here. I'll have to check later. But I think it is, like, people relate to how you are, don't they? Anyway, I was astonished. So it seems to boil down to self-acceptance, to some large degree, I think, and making more, as I've said already, of what we've already got, noticing it and making more of it. Of course, there's room for improvement, as always, but we are already enough. And I've been using that as a way into teaching metta-bhavana lately, which a number of people have fed back that they've found very, very helpful. So this comparing issue also applies to general standards that we imagine exist in the outer world. Marshall Rosenberg puts it, hell is being a parent and imagining that there is such a thing as being a good parent. That there are outer standards that exist. And, with such thoughts, we'd never be enough, would we? Another area of practice for many of us, kind of related area, is competitiveness. If I worry that there are too many trainers in my field and there won't be enough work for us all, a thought I have had on occasion, well, I've already closed down possibilities. Probably given myself a headache. And it's leaping to the future and imagining lack. Which reminds me of a remark by the American writer Mark Twain on anticipating the future. And he said, "The worst things in my life never actually happened." So anticipating lack is often self-fulfilling. You probably know that. Whereas having confidence that there is enough inspires a sense of sharing, of collaboration, and encourages everybody to contribute. So, in fact, there probably will be enough. So it's that a virtuous spiral that can happen. From experience in communication, I've also seen that focusing on what we're not getting leaves us cross or perhaps in self-pity. Whereas, let's say, if we focus on what we are getting or what we do want, the opposite can happen. So if, let's say, we're not being respected, or we feel we're not being respected, and perhaps we're reacting to the person who's spoken in a way that we didn't like, it's so much more empowering to focus on the quality that we were wanting to happen, in this case, respect. So perhaps focusing on how enriching it is to be respected, how precious respect is to everybody, how it contributes to a harmonious world. So you start really feeling your way into the quality that you're longing for rather than the lack of it. We might imagine this person acting in a respectful way. So we call this sensing the fullness of our values rather than their lack. And this shift from lack to fullness is experiential. It's not just a thought, as it were. We need to kind of really embody it. And then it can be catalytic, even quite dramatic. So we're not victims of how others respond to us. So, so much more inspiring. And in a sense, we can meet our own values just by doing that journey from lack to fullness without anything else happening in an outer sense. And a secondary benefit of that attitude is that that person is much more likely to lead them to being respectful in this example. So the law of attraction suggests that to bring something into our life, we need to live and feel as if it's possible for that to happen, as if we have what we already long for, and thereby aligning with the possibility. So if we're coming from this energy of lack, aware of what's not working for us, what we haven't got, and so on, what tends to happen is a contraction, and we come from this sort of energy of urgency or desperation. And there's a bit of a pressure on the other people or the people around us very often. Whereas if I'm in touch with the fullness and value of what I want, what also comes with it in an unspoken way is kind of hanging loose to it, really. Like, I don't have to have it. It'd be nice, but it's not vital to my life and well-being. And if we're communicating that pressure, that lack, well, other people don't like it, have you noticed? And Well, it's unskillful and it's not very enjoyable. We're much less likely for that to be, invite that energy towards us, as it were. My favourite Buddhist parable, a very famous parable, is the parable of the rain cloud. And it likens all plants to... it likens all beings to plants. Each of us, each of which responds and grows in its own particular way, watered by the rain of the Dharma. But each of us plants, while nourished by the same rain, the same sunshine, we each grow according to our own nature. So an acorn only grows into an oak tree. It's never going to grow into a shrub or a daffodil. And when I first came across this teaching, I was so happy. partly I was a bit worried that I might become a Buddhist clone, and I was convinced that I wanted to be myself. But it's definitely a metaphor, a great metaphor for spiritual growth. I really, really love how it celebrates uniqueness, our uniqueness, and that each of our skills and gifts have their own role, their own place. And it really undercuts any sense of competitive feelings, valuing diversity, and so on. And in practical ways, it reminds me to value all, and that collaboration, teamwork, and so on, are very helpful methods in practice for experiencing this diversity, experiencing abundance, you could say, rather than the either-or attitude I was mentioning. So making a conscious choice to dwell in an abundant rather than a contracted attitude is classic Dharma practice. Not always put in those very words, but it's an expression of the Buddha's core teaching on conditionality. So the Buddha pointed out that our minds create our worlds, and that there are basically two ways of functioning, the habitual and limited, or the open and creative. And this transition from the reactive to the creative, as many of you well know, is a crucial point in practicing the spiritual life. So the well-known image of the Wheel of Life depicts the automatic mode, the cyclical automatic mode. It's human life, half asleep, stuck in a rut. We probably all know it well. And we'll have a passive resistance to change if we're in that mode. And at the same time, it can seem as if our world is spinning. In fact, one friend of mine, just sitting very near here, described it as a bit like being inside a washing machine. So it's all going on all the time, and yet it's not very creative. There's movement, but not forward movement. But we can gradually slow down this spinning movement through awareness, as you probably know, and when we notice the consequences of our actions. To move off this wheel, we need to cultivate the opposite qualities of those that keep the wheel in motion. So what keeps the wheel in motion is delusion, hatred, and craving. And to slow it down, we need to cultivate the opposite qualities of love, of generosity, of clarity, and so on. And a crucial place of potential on this wheel, what's known as the gap, is the place between feeling and craving. Now, this is well-known Dharma to many of you, but for those who aren't so familiar, I'll explain that this is our point of choice. If we can feel our feelings without reacting and getting into that automatic habitual mode, craving or resisting our experience, then we can move to something more spontaneous, something more creative, something more abundant. So a key part of our kind of practical practice is noticing and making the choice. As a child, I was taught to count to 10 before replying if you're in a bad mood. So this is not bad not a bad start, but there's more than that, because we can use this pause while you're counting to 10 to actually do something different. So it's not just pause and then react as you would 10 seconds later. How can we transform using that moment, that kind of time and perspective that a pause can give us? What closes down possibility is grasping, isn't it? Seizing that, whatever it is we're after. It is the opposite of abundance. I heard a story about an Indonesian tribe who catch monkeys by placing nuts inside heavy coconut shells. And I thought this was a wonderful image for grasping. So the monkeys put their hand in after the nuts, and they try to remove them, but the fist's too fat, of course, the hole is smaller. And they will not let go of the nuts. They're not going to. And yet they can't get out. And they can't run off because it's too heavy. And it's just such a wonderful metaphor, isn't it, for how we won't let go of what we think is going to satisfy, even though we're really hampered, in this case, trapped by it. I don't know. There's a few smiles of recognition as I look around the room there. I certainly have been like those monkeys on many an occasion. What will help us to let go? Because when we cling, when we imagine or fear that we're not going to get another satisfying experience. And letting go requires a leap of faith, doesn't it? It requires a certain amount of trust that there'll be another option, something else that'll satisfy. But if we do, that'll take us through the gap, to put it in those terms. One of the oldest Buddhist texts, the Dhammapada, puts it very simply, this issue. It says, if by renouncing limited happiness, we see abundant happiness, the wise person, with the mind to abundant happiness, lets go of the limited. It just seems so obvious, doesn't it? How come we make such a big deal of it? But we're all, at times, tempted by instant gratification, aren't we? And we also know that it sours. So with attention, we can easily distinguish between the limited and the abundant modes. We know it inside, we know it outside. To me, the flavour of that reactive life is quite tight. Sometimes it's a bit dull. Because we're either resisting or we're trying to repeat the experience, and neither feel very good actually. But it's almost like we haven't stopped to think about it, or we'd realise. The creative mode, of course, feels looser, freer, more enjoyable, often very energised, I find. So when we're alive to that moment, there's no discontent, no grasping after what's not in the present. And as the William Stafford poem that I mentioned a little earlier continues, what can anyone give you greater than now? So if we're really in the present, we're not going to be grasping after what's not present. The spiral path, which is what lies ahead if we do take the opportunity of the gap, is an image of a spiral of creativity to describe positive conditionality. And this was coined by Sangharakshita, the Triratna teacher. So this is in the scriptures, but only once or twice. However, Sangharakshita's really emphasized it, and I find it a very heartening image, as I'm sure many of us do. He himself said that he himself needed the inspiration of a creative image for something to blossom inside himself. So, you know, it's something that he personally found very helpful, which I didn't realise, and I find that very encouraging. So, in this spiral of creativity, each successive stage builds on the last. So it's a building up and an overflowing of something getting fuller and spilling over. So it's not this round and round, stuck in a rut or a washing machine or wherever you might be stuck, but it's something that feels much more abundant, spilling over into the next. We feel more responsive and alive. positive emotion increases, relationships become more enjoyable, So, it's radically optimistic. And we can inhabit this place, this abundant mode, at any moment. Of course, we might slip back again, probably will. But there's no end to this creative flow. When I was first asked to give this talk on abundance, the first image that came to my mind was a cornucopia, the horn of plenty, which, that again, it also brims over. It's usually full. I looked at hundreds of images on the web, and it's usually of harvest fruit and veg, which may or may not be relevant. But the horn, I thought, was a fitting image because it itself traditionally is a spiral. And so there's a sense of movement and this overflow of riches. And of course, the spiral is an ancient image found in lots of different spiritual traditions for growth and for wisdom. The Buddha talks about these abundant states of mind in the sense of inner flourishing. And he says they're natural to the human mind. They naturally arise when we're peaceful and focused. And he's describing a kind of awareness that doesn't depend on the physical senses. It's when the mind opens effortlessly, expands into another dimension of being. And he says gladness arises when one is glad. Then joy arises when the mind's joyful. The body becomes tranquil. When the body's tranquil, one experiences happiness. The mind of someone who's happy becomes concentrated. And then he suffuses, fills, soaks, and drenches his body in a happiness and joy that comes from contemplation. So that there's no part of him that isn't drenched with this. No part of him is untouched. It sounds wonderful, doesn't it? So each stage of the creative spiral is the fruit of the last, amplifying and overflowing. And it begins with awareness of our dis-ease, of what's not quite working, and aware of the kind of dissatisfaction in life. We've agreed to have the experience. We haven't pushed it out. We've kind of gone, all right, that's how it is. And by so doing, by examining our experience and agreeing to have it, I like that phrase, okay, I'll have it, might not be my first choice, having that sense of discernment and aliveness will move us into something more positive. Another thing that comes out of this creative mindset is, it comes up in the scriptures a few times, it's described what I call knowledge of the experience. We need to be aware of what's going on. So some of the scriptures talk about faith and then knowledge of faith, joy and then knowledge of joy. And I kind of wondered whether that was important or just another of the repetitions so common to the scriptures. But studying it was very interesting to notice that it's actually another step. It makes more of, the knowledge of makes more of and deepens. I remember being on a retreat looking at this one time, and one friend of mine said rather sadly in our group, I don't really do knowledge of joy. And I went, oh dear. And then she went off for a day or two, and then she came back and she said, I do knowledge of joy. I just hadn't noticed it. And the very fact she'd had a couple of days meditating, looking at, well, is there joy in my experience? And recognizing it, it's that recognition of what's going on that amplifies and expands, which is rather what I was saying earlier on about developing abundance. So knowledge of our experiences deepens and expands it. So this shift from reactive mind to creative mind is much the same as the shift from lack to abundance that I've been talking about. Or another term that we sometimes use is shifting into the love mode from the power mode, leaving behind a utilitarian and self-concerned attitude to something much bigger, something more appreciative and open. So I'm not just talking here about states of mind that you only get in rarefied situations when you've been meditating in silence for hours. That happens too, but I'm also talking about this sense of abundance that can happen, certainly happened to me out walking on the Scottish hills or swimming in the sea in Sardinia or listening to music, whatever it is. It, in a place where you feel content and contained with what's going on, appreciative of what's going on. Sangharakshita talks about it happening very much in communication. That's a big area of possibility when we allow something new and inspiring into the dialogue. So it helps me to be really in my body, very in touch, as well as open-hearted and appreciative. Doesn't need to be coming from a special place or a special moment necessarily. It's the natural fruit of us being aware and appreciative. So I'm sure you've all had those moments. Maybe you've had them here. I think I had one in the singing workshop yesterday. Something so kind of enjoying the present, I suppose. Did you have knowledge of them as they occurred, these moments? That's a good touchstone, a good question for me. Am I noticing? 2 weeks ago, I was listening, as perhaps some of you were, to Aung San Suu Kyi, who gave the wreath lectures, or two of the wreath lectures this year. And she, in case you don't know, is the Burmese opposition leader and a Nobel Peace Prize winner. And, again, as many of you know, she's been under house arrest and imprisoned in various ways, separated from her family and oppressed in a number of horrible ways since 1988, until 6 months ago. And yet she said that she has always felt free inside, which I thought was remarkable. So she's determined not to be impoverished by her outer circumstances. Very much chosen this abundant attitude. She's in captivity, she's kept herself informed, she's continued her non-violent campaign, and maintained a real sense of dignity and perspective, very much a perspective. She said, when asked by the interviewer, she said that she felt she was much better off than many of her Burmese fellows, which of course is true, lots of them haven't survived. So very, very, very creative response. I was really inspired listening to her. And all that time, under so much oppression, she's always felt free inside. It's just that real sense of choice. One of my mentors suggests that we ask ourselves, am I living my life at a pace at which I can enjoy it? It really helps with this appreciative mode that can move us into abundance. So nowadays, when I remember, I've got a shortened version, which is, am I enjoying myself? Or am I choosing this life? Not that enjoyment's the only measure, of course. But it wakes me into that sense of appreciation, of recognizing my choices and slowing down, very probably. So there's a poem by the Indian poet Rabindranath Tagore, which I think beautifully expresses this shift from lack to abundance or reaction to creativity. He writes, I lived on the shady side of the street and watched my neighbor's gardens across the way, reveling in the sunshine. I felt I was poor and from door to door went with my hunger. The more they gave from their careless abundance, the more I became aware of my beggar's bowl. Till one morning, I awoke from my sleep at the sudden opening of my door, and you came and asked for alms. In despair, I broke open the lid of my chest and was startled into finding my own wealth. I love that last line. In despair, I broke open the lid of my chest and was startled into finding my own wealth. So, in conclusion, Meditation and contemplation are traditional routes to developing this inner abundance. I hope I've also shown how we can have an abundant attitude while working, walking, playing, talking, and experience our inner riches whenever we actively choose to. Abundance and creativity are states of mind. They're not possessions, not anything material at all. It's our choice which mindset do we want to inhabit. So this abundant attitude isn't only an inner flowering. It also helps us to relate to the outer world in a much more helpful, less grasping way. And then, of course, we can make more conscious of what we do have and glimpse the empowering possibilities of sufficiency. For what we appreciate appreciates, and what we dream we can bring into being. Thank you very much.